left him reeling. From his perspective, after all, human emotion wasn't a blessing. It was a misery and a curse. Why wouldn't I want to be rid of it? After a long hesitation, he gave a faltering nod.
Very well. I will not ask it of you again. But now, there is something else we must discuss before we continue on to the Spring Court. It's a matter of great importance.
Please, go on, I said. The frigid terror gripping me melted away bit by bit, leaving a trembling weakness behind. Seeing the green well and denying it aloud made it seem less threatening somehow. I had faced it and emerged unscathed. The ferns rustled. I looked up to find Rook pacing across the clearing.
Fair folk don't bring humans into the forest lightly. In fact, you will be the first mortal to visit the Spring Court in over 1,000 years. To avoid suspicion, we must invent some explanation for why we're traveling together. But
it can't be a lie, or else you won't be able to talk about it. He glanced at me and nodded tightly. I've always heard that the best lies are the ones closest to the truth. What will they assume first, seeing us together?
That we've fallen in love,
he said, in an utterly neutral tone. And it wouldn't be your first time. He froze. I saw what's in your raven pin, by accident, when you were unconscious. I'm sorry, Rook. I'm not going to pry, but it is relevant to our predicament. Naturally, they'd draw conclusions, however far-fetched. His stillness sank in. Dread resounded within me like the striking of a gong. My skin tightened and prickled. Are you in love with me? I blurted out. A terrible silence followed. Rook didn't turn around. Please say something. He rounded on me.
Is that so terrible? You say it as though it's the most awful thing you can imagine. It isn't as though I've done it on purpose. Somehow I've even grown fond of your irritating questions and your short legs and your accidental attempts to kill me.
I recoiled. That's the worst declaration of love I've ever heard.
How fortunate, he said bitterly. How very fortunate you are, we both are, that you feel that way. We aren't about to break the good law any time soon.
I looked away from the raw anguish in his eyes.
The love must be mutual, after all.
Good, I said to my hands.
Yes, good.
He paced back and forth.
You've made it quite clear how you feel about fair folk. Now stop making me feel things, he demanded, as though it were as easy as that. I must think.
My face felt hot and cold at once. His words rang in my head. This wasn't anything like how I'd ever imagined a romance would go, if I were to have one in the first place. God, how close we'd come to disaster. If only our sentiments for each other had overlapped. But would it have mattered? I was no longer certain that what I'd felt for Rook back in the parlor truly had been love. It had felt like it at the time. I'd never experienced anything like it before. But I'd hardly known him, even though in my feverish infatuation I'd felt as though we'd been confiding in each other for years. Could you really love someone that way, when all they were to you was a pleasant illusion? If I'd been aware he would kidnap me over a portrait, I dare say I would have changed my mind. And yet, I did feel something for him. What was that something? I picked at my emotions like a snarled knot and came no closer to finding an answer. Was I enamored with what he represented, that wistful fall wind and the promise of an end to the eternal summer? Did I only want my life to change, or did I want to change it with him? Frankly, I had no idea how anyone knew if they were in love in the first place. Was there ever a single thread a person could pick out from the knot and say, "Yes, I am in love. Here's the proof." Or was it always caught up in a wretched tangle of ifs and buts and maybes? Oh, what a mess. I planted my face in my skirts and groaned. I only knew one thing for certain. If even I couldn't figure myself out, the good law wasn't about to do it for me. Rook's shadow fell over my tumbled hair.
Your behavior is extremely distracting, he announced. I need to come up with an idea soon, or we'll be stuck here overnight.
My reply came out muffled by fabric. Whatever it is, it should have to do with craft. That's the one thing we can count on to properly distract them. Belatedly, it occurred to me that Rook wouldn't know where to begin. He didn't possess the barest inkling of what craft entailed. I snuck a peek at him through my hair and found him standing over me, looking predictably frustrated, a muscle flickering in his cheek as he clenched his jaw. That left solving things entirely up to me, which I had no doubt would turn out far better for both of us in the end. I mentally arranged our problems like dabs of paint, my presence in the forest, Rook's company, and even the dilemma of his portrait, news of which might have already reached the spring court. And like blending a new color, I began to see that something not only satisfactory, but perhaps even extraordinary, could be done with them. "Listen," I said, lifting my head. "I have an idea." Eleven. My plan required some discussion to ensure that Rook could say the necessary lines. We rehearsed it as we walked, and he was well pleased with how it sounded. I was more than a little pleased myself. I felt the glowing satisfaction of having negotiated a particularly twisty enchantment, or stretched and framed a month's worth of new canvases in advance. My world was in order again, and finally I had some measure of control over what happened to me next. Moreover, there was a chance I might even put my accidental sabotage to rights. "Do you really think it might repair your reputation?" I asked, lifting my skirts to step through a meadow of nodding yellow cowslips. Whenever the breeze changed directions, it brought a different fragrance, some I could identify and others I'd never smelled before.
"At this point, I doubt anything can," he replied with a crooked smile. "But the portrait, yes, I believe so. I'm relieved I'm no longer on the receiving end of your schemes. You're a great deal more devious than you look."
Try as I might to block it out, I heard an echo of Rook's confession in everything he said since leaving the well behind. Now that I knew to look for it, I perceived the warm admiration in his tone. While our mood might have lightened, the perfumed air hung heavy with tension. I forced out a laugh, focusing on my steps through the tall, tangled flowers. "I'm not devious, I'm just practical. But I suppose fair folk don't have much to do with the latter." He frowned, trying to figure out if I'd insulted him. "Look," I said quickly, hiding my amusement as I waded over to a great mossy stone. "This blossom's as large as my hand. I wonder what makes them grow so large." As soon as I bent down and plucked the flower, a trouser leg appeared next to me. It was made of shimmering rose-gray silk, and another, matching trouser leg followed. I started back and fell on my rear in time to watch Gadfly finish stepping out from the space between the two halves of the cracked boulder. This was made even stranger by the fact that, and I was completely certain of this, he hadn't emerged from the other side. Somehow, I'd stumbled upon the entrance to a fairy path.
"Good afternoon, Isabel,"
he said pleasantly, straightening his impeccably tied cravat. He didn't seem at all surprised to find me sitting on the ground in front of him, alarmed and clutching a cowslip. As the shock wore off, I found I was terribly happy to see him. The homesickness I hadn't had time to indulge in these past few days struck me like a runaway carriage. I'd spent years with him in my parlor, and though his pale blue eyes betrayed not the slightest genuine warmth, his face was more familiar a sight than anything else I'd laid eyes upon since leaving home. I nearly exclaimed his name, but caught myself at the last second. My manners had deteriorated appallingly during my time with Rook. "It's wonderful to see you, Gadfly," I said, standing up to curtsy. "Did Rook inform you of our arrival?" If he had, it was news to me. He swept me a bow, then sent Rook a pointed look.
"Does our dear Rook ever bother with common courtesy? No, I simply knew you were coming. Very few things escape my attention in the Springlands, even the plucking of a flower."
I looked at the cowslip guiltily.
"Do keep it," he urged, "as a welcome to my domain."
While I digested his curious words, he swept past me and walked a circle around Rook, who withstood the inspection with a lifted chin and a set jaw. Comparing them, I was oddly proud to note that Rook was several inches taller. His dark, tousled hair and striking eyes set him apart like night from day in contrast to Gadfly's refined pastel pallor. Though by far the younger of the two, he was in every way Gadfly's equal.
"Those clothes are at least 50 years out of fashion," Gadfly was telling him. "No one wears copper buttons in the spring court. If you insist on staying, we'll have to find..."
Whatever he said next, and whatever Rook said in reply, was lost to me as I finished digesting that phrase. "A welcome to my domain." I cleared my throat. Gadfly looked around.
"Sir, are you the Spring Prince?" I asked.
He smiled.
"Why, yes, none other. Surely I've mentioned that to you before."
"No, I can't say you have."
"How remiss of me. I'm so forgetful with mortals. I simply assume everyone already knows."
While Gadfly spoke, Rook studied him with an unreadable expression.
"Well, fear not, Isabel. Your manners are beyond reproach. I always felt welcomed as a princely figure in your home. Now, before I forget another detail, would you care to tell me why you're roaming about in the forest and in such distinguished company?"
"Actually..." I glanced at Rook. I was grateful we'd planned on having him explain, because the revelation about Gadfly's rank had left me quite speechless.
"Let's discuss it as we walk," he suggested, yanking his coat straight and tightening his sword belt, rather crossly, I thought.
I wondered if he'd taken Gadfly's criticisms to heart. Then he set off through the meadow, leaving us to catch up.
"He's a singular fellow, isn't he?" Gadfly said.
How could I possibly answer that without giving anything away? I settled for the blandest reply I could think of.
"Indeed, sir. I find all fair folk to be quite singular."
"Oh, how I wish that were so. But we're all the same, I'm afraid."
He gave me a smile as subtle and chilly as a spring thaw.
"Most of us. Now, Rook, you were saying..."
Pacing along in front, Rook was clearly growing tired of all the cowslips.
"As you know," he said impatiently, "Isabel is the most distinguished crafter in Whimsy at present. The portrait she painted for me was unlike anything we've ever seen in the Autumn Court." "So I heard,"
Gadfly replied. It took a monumental effort of will not to look at him and gauge his reaction.
"It shocked us, myself most of all. At first I imagined it to be an act of sabotage for which Isabel should stand trial. But on the way to the Autumn Court, I discovered that she had no harmful intentions. She merely painted a human emotion on my face, and skillfully, without understanding what she had done."
This was all true, in a manner of speaking.
"Now Isabel is interested in replicating her newfound craft."
"Human emotions, Gadfly," I said to him, my confidence swelling the further we got without slipping up. "You've sampled everything craft has to offer. Tea cakes and china, silk suits, books, swords. We keep coming up with different versions of the same old things, but I think what I'd like to try is completely new. I could put true joy on your face, wonder on someone else's, laughter or wrath, even sorrow. Rook has informed me your kind will find this most diverting."
"So I've brought her to the Spring Court, where she might demonstrate first for her most dedicated patrons," Rook finished grandly. "If the results are satisfactory, I do believe such craftsmanship deserves a just reward. I propose that should she choose to take it, Isabel's payment will be a trip to the Green Well."
My smile radiated innocence. A trip to it, not a drink from it.
"Something completely new,"
Gadfly mused in a faraway voice. Briefly, he looked much older than his apparent age. The bees stopped droning in the honeyed air, and all the songbirds stilled. I held my breath along with the rest of the world.
"Yes. Yes, I think that's just the thing, Isabel. Rook, I would be delighted to host you. For as long as you're in the Spring Court, you will want for nothing."
We reached the court much sooner than I expected, and I almost walked straight in without realizing we'd arrived. Birch trees, wider than a man was tall, grew around us, soaring to impossible heights. Craning my neck, I saw that their branches were woven together much in the same way as rook shelters, with songbirds and jewel-bright hummingbirds flitting among them. The only tree that stood apart from the rest was an old, knotted dogwood in full bloom, elevated on a mossy knoll. It had grown into a strange shape, and puzzling over this, I realized it was no normal tree, but in fact a throne. As soon as I drew that conclusion, the forest around me changed. Silvery laughter filled the air, and with a shimmer like steam escaping a teapot, brocade chairs, silken pillows, and picnic blankets unfurled across the flowery meadow. Previously unseen, dozens, if not hundreds, of fair folk watched us approach from various states of repose. My knees turned to water, and I had to force myself to keep walking. I'd never seen a fraction this many fair folk in a single place at once. Worse, they weren't watching us after all. They stared at me and me alone, the first mortal to enter their court in over 1,000 years. As we neared the throne, a girl rose from a blanket. She seemed to be having tea, but all the teacups were empty, and pelted toward us, her long blonde hair flying, the many layers of her periwinkle blue gown frothing up and down like waves. When she reached us, she startled me by seizing both my hands. Her skin was cold and flawless as china. Were she human, I would have guessed her age at around 14.
"Oh, a mortal! Gadfly, you've brought us a mortal!" she cried, in a simulacrum of rapturous delight,
revealing that all of her little white teeth were as pointed as a shark's.
"We simply must introduce her to Aster. She'll be ever so pleased. Are you going to drink from the green well?"
She shifted her attention to me.
"Please say yes. Please say yes. We can be the best of friends. Of course, we can still be friends if you don't, but you'll die so quickly it would hardly be worth it."
Gadfly's hand alit on her shoulder.
"Isabel, this is my..." He searched for the words. "Niece, Lark. Please forgive her excitability. This is her very first time meeting a mortal. I trust she'll be on her best behavior with you as our honored guest."
This was clearly more for Lark's benefit than mine. I gave her an awkward curtsy, which was difficult with her still clinging to my hands, but apparently it counted, because to my relief she let go and curtsied back. My fingers felt as though they'd been immersed in ice. "It's a pleasure to meet you, Lark."
"Of course it is," she said.
"And you already know Rook?"
Gadfly went on pleasantly.
"Hello, Rook," said Lark, without ever taking her eyes off my face. "Can you turn into a hare for me again and let me chase you about?"
Rook laughed.
"That was a child's game, Lark. You're a young lady now."
"You're no fun. Poor Isabel, she must be ever so bored with you. Can I put her in some new clothes?"
she asked Gadfly, whose smile was acquiring a fixed quality.
"In a moment, darling. For now, Isabel and I must discuss her craft. Why don't you have a seat beside the throne and think about the dresses you'd like her to wear? Remember, she cannot use glamour, so it must be a new dress."
He inclined his head meaningfully.
"Oh, fine."
She collapsed next to the throne in a tragic heap of blue chiffon.
"Now," Gadfly said, arranging himself elegantly on the dogwood's platform, "what will we need to provide you with so you may work your craft? I'm afraid we have no materials similar to what I've seen in your parlor. I can send for supplies from Whimsy, but my court is terribly busy preparing for the masquerade, and it may take some time to have them delivered."
I resisted glancing at the fair folk around us, none of whom were doing anything more productive than nibbling on shortbread. "Let me think, sir. What could I use? First, I'd need a substitute for canvas or paper. Perhaps sheets of bark, thin and pale in color, sturdy but flexible enough to straighten out without breaking. Birch bark might do well, and there looks to be plenty of it." Was it my imagination, or were the branches on Gadfly's throne moving? "And then," I went on, unnerved by the idea that his dogwood might have taken offense, "I think I can gather natural pigments myself. I used to do so often as a child."
"Excellent,"
he said, tapping a spidery finger against his lips.
And a chair, and a stand for you to put the bark on?
That sounds very good, sir. I hadn't the slightest idea what I might use in place of a brush or pencil, but I'd figure something out. I'd use my fingers if I had to. Because of the difference in materials, the portraits won't look like the ones I usually do, nor will they last as long. But if you're pleased with the work, I would be happy to do them over in oils, using my normal method, that is, I added, aware that he might not understand.
Now can I dress her?
Said Lark's voice from the ground, where she was still collapsed in the same piteous heap. Gadfly raised his eyebrows at me. I said. Yes, I suppose. Though I should...
You're going to try everything on!
Lark exclaimed, her cold hand closing around my wrist like a vice. Before I knew it, I was being dragged through the laughing picnickers with little hope for escape. I glanced over my shoulder at Rook, who watched me go intently, and had the comforting thought that he'd find some excuse before long to make sure I didn't suffocate in last century's silk bustles. Lark towed me toward one of the giant birches, which had thick vines winding up it like a spiral stair. She mounted this dubious-looking feature without hesitation while hauling me behind. We went higher and higher, the fair folk on the ground receding to the size of toy soldiers. I found that if I paid close attention to where I stepped on the knobbly roots, didn't look down, and held on to the bark with my free hand, I could resist the urge to vomit on Lark's chiffon. She chattered at me gaily the entire time without seeming to mind that I didn't once reply. At the top, we emerged into a leafy labyrinth. It reminded me a bit of a hedge maze, if instead of hedges, there were arched bowers of white, wicker-like branches filled in with pale green leaves. The ground felt springy, but otherwise solid. I wouldn't have minded walking across it if I hadn't known about the long drop beneath. Items of craft lay jumbled all along the pathways, climbing the walls in teetering stacks of furniture, cushions, books, paintings, and porcelain wares. Jewelry dangled glittering from upended chair legs. Spiders wove glistening webs over atlases and bronze coat racks.
"This way!"
Lark cried. She whipped me around with nearly enough force to dislocate my shoulder and took off down one of the corridors. Racing behind her, I frequently had to hop sideways to skim through the narrow aisles, and suspected I rendered a few spiders homeless along the way. She said,
"I keep my dresses in the bird hole. We name all our rooms, even though they aren't really rooms, because that's what mortals do."
"Oh, how nice," I replied faintly, filled with dread. As it turned out, however, the unpropitious-sounding bird hole looked more or less like the rest of the labyrinth, except that it was a dome-shaped room protruding from one of the corridors and had songbirds roosting in it, which flew off in a melodic explosion when we entered. Blossoming vines shielded the far wall like a curtain. Lark finally released my abused wrist to go root around in it, vanishing up to the waist.
"Here,"
she said, thrusting a pile of chiffon through the curtain into my arms.
"Take off your boring old brown dress and put this on. It might be long on you because you're short, but you can change it, can't you? And then put it back the same way afterward?"
It took me a moment to understand what she meant. I don't do that sort of craft, unfortunately. I can sew a bit, mend tears and that sort of thing, but I'm not a tailor. Lark straightened and stared at me without comprehension. Her large, widely set blue eyes gave her the look of an inquisitive sparrow. If not for the teeth, I would have found her countenance very charming. I tried. "Some fair folk have different types of magic, don't they? Magic that's unique to them, or a small number of your kind, such as Rook being able to change his shape, for example."
"Yes," she exclaimed, "just like how Gadfly knows things before they happen."
I filed that information away for later. "Well, that's also how it is with mortals and the craft. My specialty is making pictures of people's faces. I can do a little with food, but not much with clothes, and nothing at all with weapons."
"Who needs weapons anyway? If I were a mortal, I'd want craft to make dresses. Please, won't you hurry up and put that on?"
I regarded the pink fabric grimly. "I suppose. Hold it for me while I get ready." I handed it back and stripped off my dress. For the lack of a better place to put it, I laid it out on the ground and then struggled into the new dress with Lark's help, which involved an unnecessary amount of poking and prodding. All the while, I thought of the iron ring hidden away in my pocket and wished I'd thought to put it in my stocking instead.
"You look much better," she said gravely when we were finished. "Except pink isn't your color. Take it off again."
She dove back to the closet. I was stepping out of the wads of fabric when a rustling sound came from the wall. I turned to find a raven poking its beak through the branches. It angled its head this way and that, snatching at the leaves and tearing them off to make room for itself, cocking a demanding purple eye in our direction. Relief swept through me, chased by the prickling awareness that I stood there in my undergarments. I snatched my arms against my chest just as Rook popped his head the rest of the way through. Stuck halfway in and out of the wall, he made an irritable burbling sound in his throat. I couldn't help it. I laughed. It was hard to remain self-conscious in front of a bird. "All right, hold still," I told him. I went over and slipped my hand in next to his feathers and pulled the branches aside. He flapped down to the floor. With a self-important air, he strutted across the room and tugged on the hem of Lark's dress.
"Stop," she said. "I'm busy. I won't break her, I promise."
Rook and I exchanged a look. She'd just given her word, whether she meant to or not, but I had to wonder if it counted for much, given how unlikely she was to understand how, exactly, one went about breaking a mortal. She spun around.
"This one."
Her face glowed with satisfaction. Oh, God. It was a Firth and Maester's. I took it reluctantly, as one might a queen's diamond necklace, and held it close with my knees pressed together, overwhelmingly mindful of Rook standing just a few feet away. "Lark, I don't know about this one. I have to go tromping around in the woods looking for berries after we're done, and I'd hate to damage it."
"Why would you care about that?"
"Well, because then it's ruined. Wouldn't Gadfly be upset if he had to replace it?"
"You silly. Watch."
She fetched another dress from inside the vines. Involuntarily, I recoiled. It looked like it had served as a wedding dress long ago, but its once white fabric was soiled and graying, riddled with moth holes. The ribbons dangling from the waist were so rotten, one of them dropped off when Lark pulled it against herself. But as soon as the dress touched her body, it unrolled new lengths of snowy satin. Lace restored itself like blossoms unfurling, and the ribbons spooled down to her toes, pristine. Just like that, the dress looked freshly sewn, without the slightest trace of decay. Seeing my expression, Lark shrieked with laughter, showing every one of her pointed teeth. Then she stopped laughing all at once, as though she'd shut the lid on a music box.
"That's what he meant when he told me to get you new ones," she explained. "But we can only make them look exactly how they did when they were made, so I can't change its shape if I want to, or add anything on."
She sized me up. I could tell she was about to ask about my sewing skills again, so I swiftly donned the Firth and Maester's dress before she had a chance. It was made of gorgeous sage-green satin. The bodice was embroidered with tiny songbirds in silver thread, and a cream-colored satin ribbon marked its raised waistline, beneath which an additional layer of sheer muslin draped over the green underskirt. I felt diaphanous and shimmering, like a dragonfly's wing. Ordinarily, I'd never wear anything half this fine without a petticoat underneath, and the sleek fabric slid unfamiliarly over my bare legs, a touch as silky and subtle as water. It looked terribly at odds with my stout leather half-boots peeking out beneath the hem, but that was one aspect of my wardrobe I refused to compromise. I never knew when I might have to run. "Perfect for berry picking," I joked weakly.
"What about you?"
Lark demanded of Rook, who was watching me with a cocked head. Warmth flooded my cheeks, and I resisted the urge to fold my arms again, even though there was nothing to hide.
"Has Gadfly changed you out of those dreary autumn lands clothes?"
Wind shook the bird hole, and Rook materialized beside us, looking rumpled and cross.
"Yes, that was his first order of business, unsurprisingly, but these colors don't suit me at all."
Don't be a spoilsport. Black and brown and whatever else you had on suit everyone poorly. I think you look awfully fine.
I believe we must agree to disagree about fashion,
he replied with dignity.
Also, it wasn't brown. It was copper.
Copper,
she repeated, and gave another shriek of laughter, though the source of her amusement eluded me. To be perfectly frank, Rook could trail about in a bedsheet and still look magnificent, but he did look better in his own clothes. The fern-green jacket Gadfly had scrounged up for him didn't match his darker complexion or his hair, and fit too tightly across the shoulders. His embattled cravat showed signs of restless clawing. I doubted it was long for this world. But I thought, Riley, at least we matched.
Are the two of you finished? I've been ordered to bring Isabel back down for introductions once she's dressed. And you can help introduce her, of course,
he added to Lark, who was summoning a pout.
Oh, all right,
she seized his arm. Rook lifted his other elbow meaningfully, and I smiled and shook my head. We'll never make it through those corridors if we're promenading arm in arm. I'd impale myself on a coat rack.
Just do it, Isabel, Lark cried. We aren't going that way.
What other way could there possibly be? Certain I was about to experience another fairy strangeness I'd rather go without, I took Rook's offered arm. I observed how delicate my hand and wrist looked resting on his sleeve, and conceded it was possible to see how fair folk got so vain, parading around in firth and maesters, and constantly discussing which colors looked best on them. Rook looked down, his gaze stripped bare. He really is in love with me, I thought. My heart leapt forward like a startled deer. Seeing a confession of love in his eyes was nothing like hearing it declared aloud. This was a look that would make time stop if it could. Soft and sharp at once, an aching tenderness edged with sorrow, naked proof of a heart already broken. Here I stood in a dragonfly dress, holding his arm, and he knew our time was almost over. A thousand wings unfurled inside me. I chased after them, trying to silence them, stuff them back down where they'd do no harm, but I might as well have been in the middle of a whirling vortex of butterflies, attempting to capture each one by hand. I became conscious of the heat of Rook's skin through the fabric of his silk jacket, and that ever so slightly, my hand had begun trembling. He couldn't say anything in front of Lark, and he didn't need to. I saw everything I needed to know reflected back at me in his eyes. What was I feeling? How could I be certain? Love between us was impossible. I forced myself to confront what would become of us if I allowed this feeling to take flight. There were only two options, drink from the green well, or condemn us both to death. Meeting his gaze, I let the resolve show on my face. I could permit neither. I was stronger than my emotions. If I lived 1,000 times, not once would I destroy my own life and another's for love. A storm gathered in my breast. The butterflies fell fluttering weakly to the ground. With a sharp intake of breath, Rook looked away. According to my head, I'd done the right thing. But my heart yawned dark and hollow with the emptiness his averted gaze left behind. I wondered if my head and heart would ever reconcile, or whether I just cursed myself to relive this moment for the rest of my years, half assured I'd made the only choice available to me, half always whispering, "If only," the whole of me filled with bitter regret. The bird hole creaked. The floor shivered beneath my feet, and the wall's wicker branches began twining about like thread in a loom, weaving, tumbling, bowing outward. I clenched Rook's arm by reflex. Lark howled devilishly at the look on my face. All around us the room transformed, and a panicked thought gripped me. During that single intimate moment, had Rook and I broken the good law after all? The wicker floor cascaded downward, starting at the tips of my shoes. Slender birch supports rose from the ground to meet the newly forming stairway at intervals, creating elegant arches above and below, their branches fanning out as banisters. In mere seconds, I stood at the top of a broad, sweeping stair, grander than that of any palace, stretching down 5 stories or more. At the bottom, a crowd of fair folk awaited, arranged around a semicircle of open grass to which I assumed we were about to descend. Gadfly knelt in the middle of it, his hair glinting silver in the sun. As I watched, he stood, reviewed the tip of his index finger, and then discreetly brought it to his lips, sucking away the blood. He had done all of this, it seemed, with little more than a single drop. My pulse raced, stumbling along. Though my worst fear hadn't come to pass, I now possessed ample material with which to replace it. There were even more fair folk gathered here than there had been in the meadow before, and as grand as Rook looked beside me, I was the one they'd truly come to see. All of them were dressed to perfection in the delicate pinks, greens, blues, and yellows of a spring garden, resplendent in silver embroidery and mother-of-pearl buttons, with jewelry that glittered as brightly as their immortal eyes. I knew if I walked among them for hours, I wouldn't find a single chipped nail or hair out of place, and I also knew that each and every one of them could kill me as easily and as casually as dropping a teacup. Gadfly inclined his head to us. 1 foot in front of the other, that's all it took. Yet the descent seemed to stretch on for minutes rather than seconds, and the crowd waited in complete silence, the only sound the susurrus of my gown's fabric slithering over the steps behind us. The closer we grew, the more unnatural the multitude of fair folk looked. The flawlessness that only nagged at me a little in the presence of one or two of their kind amplified to a sensation of dread when I was confronted by so many, as though I were beheld by an army of living dolls. As soon as my first shoe touched the grass, a delicate chime of laughter, sighs, and whispered conversation rippled outward through the crowd, and so the introductions began. When Gadfly turned around, scrabbling ensued among the fair folk in the front. A woman with arresting hazel eyes emerged victorious. She adjusted her hat back into place with a queenly smile as she swept forward, placing her hand in Gadfly's. She wore a lilac dress with a high lace collar that strangled her slender neck, and the flaw in her glamour, unnaturally sharp cheekbones, was more subtle than most. Like many of the other fair folk present, she was fair-skinned, a common spring court characteristic, whereas the autumn and summer courts tended toward richer complexions like Rook's, every shade of sunlight gold and acorn brown and deep umber.
"Isabel, I'd like you to meet Foxglove," said Gadfly.
I curtsied deeply.
"Foxglove, this is Isabel, though you already know her by reputation."
She curtsied back. I knew her by reputation, too. She was the fair one who'd stolen Mrs. Firth's vowels. I had always counted myself lucky that she'd never come calling on me.
"I am utterly thrilled by your visit," she said, leaning close enough that her breath tickled my hair.
It had a sweet, flowery aroma over a base note of some rich and deadly spice.
"I've followed your work ever since it began appearing in the courts. I would so love to have a portrait done while you're here."
My jaw already ached from smiling, and the ordeal had only just begun.
"Thank you. It would be my pleasure."
"You're a darling," she replied, with hunger in her eyes. Fair folk came forward in an endless stream. Soon my knees creaked from curtsying and pleasantries numbed my brain. The whole time, Rook and I stood side by side as if we were strangers, never meeting each other's eyes. Many of the fair folk I greeted were current or former patrons, like Swallowtail, who loudly engaged me in a conversation about his past commission, as others in line peered jealously over his shoulders. All of them were familiar with my craft. As the afternoon dragged on, I grew increasingly impatient. I needed time to gather supplies before dusk. More importantly, I needed to send word of my situation to Emma. In writing, now that I was at last in a position to do so. News delivered verbally by a fair folk messenger, if indeed Gadfly could spare one from a tea party, would only leave her stewing until the sun came up, trying to figure out if I was really dead or injured, and they'd figured out some twisty way to make it sound otherwise. so I was distracted, wondering how I could escape before it grew too late, when Gadfly pulled forth another fair one and introduced her as Aster.
"I think you will be particularly delighted to meet our Aster," he said, with an extra veneer of enthusiasm. "She was a mortal once, like you, and drank from the green well. When was that, Aster?"
"It must have been some centuries ago now, though it seems like just yesterday," she replied in a soft, wispy voice, like willow branches stirred by a breeze.
My attention snapped back into focus at once. Had I not known, I wouldn't have been able to tell Aster apart from the rest. She was perhaps a little less tall, but not remarkably so. Flowers were woven into her wavy, waist-length black hair. Her skin looked starkly pale in contrast, which only accentuated her glamour's flaw. She was inhumanly gaunt. Her collarbones and ribs protruded from her chest above her gown's neckline, and her shoulders looked as fragile as a bird's bones. She watched me closely with brown eyes nearly as dark as mine. We exchanged curtsies.
"It's a pleasure to meet you, Aster. I hope to drink from the green well one day myself."
The ability to lie had never seemed as useful or necessary.
"How do you find being a fair one?"
She gave me a flickering smile that didn't reach the rest of her face.
"It's lovely, you know. There are so few things to worry about. I hardly ever have cares these days. I remember getting sick, or the way I used to feel pain, and there's so much less of it now."
Her smile faded and came back.
"That sounds wonderful."
I was aware of everyone watching me and made sure my expression didn't change.
"The forest is so beautiful compared to Whimsy."
"Yes," she said.
"Oh, yes."
"Were you a master of the craft?" I inquired. Her wan smile lit her face like the striking of a flint.
"I was. One must be to drink from the well, of course. Let's see, I was..."
She faltered horribly.
"You know, I seem to have forgotten the name for it. Ha ha, how strange."
My skin crawled, a thousand many-legged insects skittering from my scalp all the way down to my toes. I desperately hoped the fair folk couldn't see my hair standing on end.
"Perhaps you could describe it to me," I suggested, "and I'll find the name for you." "Well, I made words. I made words for books, the ones that tell stories that aren't true. Isn't that odd? I used to do that myself."
"You're a writer," I said. Her pupils swallowed up her eyes. For a heartbeat, I had the terrifying notion she was about to leap at me and tear my throat out. Then I saw her hands fisted so tightly, gripping the fabric of her dress, that her knuckles bulged white and her fingers looked fit to break.
"Yes, that's it. I was a writer. Ha ha, a writer. Silly me, one does forget such things. We all forget things from time to time."
"Yes, we certainly do." I kept my voice steady with an effort. "May I ask, did you also have the pleasure of visiting the Spring Court before you drank from the well?"
"Oh, no," she said. "How splendid that would have been. I only came here afterwards, once I'd transformed."
How many fair folk had Aster met before she made her decision? How much had she understood about the consequences of her choice? I couldn't continue my line of questioning without risking suspicion, but it seemed to me that she might not have known what was in store for her, not truly, the same as everyone back in Whimsy.
"I see," I replied. "It was a pleasure to meet you, Aster." "I'm so glad we had the chance to talk. I do hope you follow in my footsteps. It would be lovely to have you here in the Spring Court. Just lovely."
Her fingers gripped and loosened.
"Perhaps we might speak a second time before you return to Whimsy, so you can remind me of that word again. Oh, it's amusing how forgetful I am."
My smile felt carved onto my face as she took her leave. Rook shifted beside me, but I dared not look at him. I was chilled to the marrow of my bones. The wintry calls of the Wild Hunt's hounds rose again in my ears, and I saw Hemlock's white, wild-eyed face receding into the darkness. I recalled the hunger tearing forth from beneath the polite, cold smile of every fair one I had ever painted. How was it that we had ever come to admire the fair folk, even hope to become them?
Gadfly, Rook said cheerfully, I believe Isabel has had enough for the day. You know how mortals are, hardly able to stand up for an hour or two before they collapse from exhaustion. If we're to have any hope of seeing her craft tomorrow, she will require her remaining energy for, well, whatever it is she needs to do this evening.
I heard, rather than saw, his charming half-smile.
Good gracious, we mustn't interfere with her craft.
Gadfly raised his voice.
Ladies and gentlemen of the court, you will simply have to wait. We will convene again at supper.
Unhappy exclamations engulfed me. Murmured conversation followed. Numbly, I took Rook's offered hand and allowed him to lead me away from the bottom of the stairs. Lark gambolled after us, waving at her friends, who watched us go with resentful scowls, which to all appearances, Lark enjoyed immensely.
Now we have you all to ourselves, she said, coming around to take my other arm.
Rook grimaced, struggling to contain his frustration. He couldn't speak freely in Lark's presence, but her company was a blessing for the same reason. We couldn't be seen alone together too often without drawing suspicion. I nodded at him, hoping it would tell him everything he wanted to know. I was all right. I was grateful for his intervention, but it didn't make him look any happier. Lark swung our arms back and forth.
You're awfully quiet, Isabel. You really must be exhausted. What's it like?
What's what like?
Being exhausted, of course.
Even after spending years in their company, fair folk still had the capacity to surprise me.
It makes you want to sit down, I suppose, or go to sleep. Anything that doesn't require you to move or think. So it's like having too much wine,
Lark said knowingly. I raised my eyebrows, thinking that if Gadfly were human, someone would need to have a talk with him.
Yes, but without the good parts. And, most of the bad parts, really, I added, recalling my first and last experience with Emma's holiday brandy.
Lark shrieked straight into my ear.
That doesn't make any sense at all, she said once she'd recovered. What are we going to do now? Please don't take a nap. It would be ever so dull.
No, I'd like to get started gathering materials for pigments. Do you think the two of you could help? I shot Rook a sideways glance. Or is that chore beneath the prince? Finally, he smiled, a real smile this time, dimple and all.
Ordinarily, I'd say so, but I find I can't pass up the chance to get stains all over Gadfly's wretched clothes. It may not matter to Lark, but it certainly does to him. So tell us what to find, and we are at your service.
They took me some distance from what I had begun to think of as the Spring Court's throne room to a place that looked more like normal forest, and sat me down on a stump. There I described to them what I needed. Blueberries, blackberries, elderberries, mulberries, any berries they could find, wild onions and apple bark for yellow, walnut shells for brown. For black I could use soot.
But what are the eggs for?
Rook asked indignantly, looming above me at his full height. I need something to bind the pigments into paints. Typically one uses linseed or spike lavender oil, but egg yolk is a readier alternative. Seeing his expression, I added, Just don't collect raven's eggs, for heaven's sake. Oh, and get fresh ones. I can't have chicks popping out of them.
I'll eat those for you,
Lark assured me, the very image of a proper young lady. You'd get along with my... Never mind. God, how could I sit here enjoying myself while my family waited at home, thinking me dead or worse? Rook glanced at me, but fortunately Lark didn't notice anything amiss.
Let's see who can get them first, she cried, and vanished.
A bush's leaves trembled nearby, as though someone had whipped past them at a high speed.
Isabel, Rook said softly, when you spoke to Aster...
Lark's voice interrupted from far away.
Hurry up!
He hesitated, torn. I glanced around to make sure we were alone, then took his hand. Right away, he looked down at our intertwined fingers as though they contained the secrets of the universe. Go on, I said. I'm the one who came up with this plan, remember? Right now, I could really use your help. Conflict played over his features, but Lark called for him again, and he didn't linger. That evening, the fair folk gathered to watch the preparations for my craft. We'd set up in the same clearing so we didn't have to go back and forth, and it wasn't long before the court arrived, more ethereal lords and ladies appearing unnervingly from thin air whenever I turned my back. Fascinated, they watched me grind up the berries, shells, and bark on a flat stone, then scrape them into a collection of porcelain bowls and teacups Lark had brought from the labyrinth. I cracked the tiny songbird eggs, strained the whites out with my fingers, and mixed the yolk and pigments using a twig. A campfire's sticks popped and shifted nearby, producing the charred wood I'd need for soot. Pigments were expensive. Before gaining the fair folk's patronage, I'd only used charcoal, along with whatever colors I could make myself, and as I worked, my childhood experiments came back to me. Blackberries made the deepest, richest red. Elderberries dried with an ochre tint. Mixed with walnut shell, mulberries created a pleasant medium brown with wine purple undertones. And blueberries often went on pink, only to darken to a deep indigo over the course of a day. Perhaps ironically, green was the most difficult of all colors to achieve from nature. I would need to experiment with the yellows cooked from onion skin and apple bark, and see what they looked like mixed with my blues. So absorbed was I that for a time I forgot my audience, focusing on the rapture of color alone. The sun slanted lower and lower, casting a golden edge on my makeshift tools and feathering my hair with light. Finally, I finished crushing the charred wood from the fire. "I think I'm done," I said, meaning to address Rook and Lark, but found I spoke instead to an entire crowd of fair folk clustered around me.
"Marvelous," Gadfly declared,
as though I were a court alchemist transmuting lead into gold, while I sat looking up at him with egg slime all over my fingers. He offered me a square of peeled birch bark, and I wiped my hands off on the ground before I took it. "Thank you," I said. "This looks like it will do nicely. Would it be all right if I requested a favor?" Gadfly inclined his head.
"I did tell you you would want for nothing."
"If I write a letter to my family in Whimsy, may I have it delivered? Even by bird, if that's something that can be arranged. The earliest date possible would be ideal," I added hastily, aware that otherwise it might arrive at the front door of our abandoned, tumble-down cottage 100 years late.
"Certainly. I give my word that your letter will reach your home by sunrise 2 days hence."
"And my Aunt Emma will receive it," I pressed, sensing another loose end. He gave me a knowing smile.
"Never one to forget a detail. I promise it shall be delivered directly into Emma's hand. Now, I confess, I've never had the good fortune to watch writing craft."
And with that, he seated himself next to me, cross-legged, to watch. "I'm happy to demonstrate," I replied, trying to ignore his close attention. He peered at the bark in my hand as though I were about to wave my hand and transform it into a dove. I reached for the soot bowl, but halted halfway with a sinking realization. "I haven't anything to write with," I said to myself aloud, casting about. Wind stirred my hair, and Rook hopped onto the stump beside me in raven form, twisting his head to preen his tail feathers. Just when I was about to shoo him off, he seized the longest feather and yanked it from his body. This he handed to me with courtly aplomb. It was warm, and the end of the translucent shaft contained a bead of his amber blood. I turned the feather in my hands, running my fingertip along its silky edge to buy myself a little time. I wasn't certain why I felt so touched by the gesture. The feather was one of many, and Rook could grow it back in an instant. When I could stall no longer, I cleared my throat and dabbed its tip on the ground to clean it. That was, perhaps, a mistake. Right away, the grass bulged, and a sapling pushed forth from the wildflowers, rapidly straining upward into a young tree, unfolding branches like a stage prop.
Vivid scarlet leaves burst forth in glorious bloom, its foliage spread across the spring glade triumphantly, and a bit obnoxiously, in what struck me as a truly rook-like fashion.
"Have a care," Gadfly exclaimed. "I won't see you defacing my court, Rook. That's terribly unsightly."
Rook spread his wings and released a series of belligerent croaks. I hid a smile.
"Thank you," I whispered to him, rolling the feather's stem between my fingertips.
Gadfly soon forgot the offense as I began scratching out my letter in wet soot. Fair folk might not be able to write, but they could certainly read, so I needed to be careful about what I revealed. "Dear Emma, March, and May," I wrote, "I am safe and well. It pains me to think of the distress my disappearance must have caused you. The truth is that I have been on an unexpected adventure." I knew Emma would understand how I felt about being on an adventure, "and haven't had the opportunity to write you until now. Presently, I'm demonstrating my craft in the spring court. I was brought here by Rook, the Autumn Prince, who spirited me away quite suddenly. I look forward to seeing you all again soon. With love, Isabel." This would give Emma more questions than answers, but I was running out of room on the little square of bark, so it would have to do. I waited for it to dry, then handed it to Gadfly. He brought the letter close to his face, examining it with remote fascination.
"So simple an act," he said eventually. "And yet, do you know that if a fair one were to attempt what you have just done, he would crumble to dust?"
"I've heard that, yes."
Gadfly's pale gaze flicked to me.
"Make no mistake, it's a small price to pay for the power and beauty of immortality. Yet it does make one wonder, doesn't it? Why do we desire, above all other things, that which has the greatest power to destroy us?"
A chill brushed my spine. Never before had I known Gadfly to wax philosophical about anything more profound than lemon curd. I resisted the urge to look at Rook, wondering if he shared my unease.
"Craft itself doesn't harm you," I pointed out. "You wear it and eat it every day without consequences."
"Ah, yes. Still,"
he summoned a faint smile,
"some consequences go unseen. One day you might discover that craft has the power to undo my kind in ways you'd never imagined." "Well, that sounded quite depressing, didn't it? I do apologize."
He winked at me. Then he clapped his hands and stood. Only then did I realize the letter was gone, vanished from his grasp too quickly for me to detect. He'd given his word, I reminded myself, shaking myself free from the lingering oddness of our conversation. Emma would receive it. She'd read it soon, and still fear for me, but at least not think me dead.
"Who would like to help Isabel convey her crafting materials to the throne?"
Gadfly asked, as if mustering a group of schoolchildren. Immediately, I was surrounded by a tittering crowd of fair folk, lifting the bowls and examining them. At first, I was concerned they might upset some of my pigments, but that worry faded when I saw them handle the vessels as though they were enchanted goblets, liable to explode or turn anyone nearby to stone if dropped. Rook, apparently, had done enough helping for the day, because when I stood, he flapped over my shoulder until I gave him permission to perch there, and then sat, regarding everyone with an upturned beak. We walked back in a procession like something out of a tapestry, me at the very front, wearing a gossamer gown with a prince riding on my shoulder in animal guise, and a fairy host parading behind. The setting sun lit everything aglow, so that even the insects rising from the disturbed wildflowers looked like motes of gold suspended in the air. When we reached the throne room, it became clear work had been done in my absence. A long table was set up along the birch-lined path to the throne, caparisoned in white cloth and draped down the center with an embroidered runner that must have measured 40 feet or more. Its pale green and silver silk matched the chair cushions and the designs on the fine china place settings. But the food put it all to shame. Glittering mounds of grapes and plums and cherries, stacks of frosted pastries, roast goose and partridge still gleaming from the spit.
"Who's done it all?" I murmured to Rook. Does everyone take turns at playing servant, or do the squirrels and hares come pouring out of the woods to set everything up while you're gone? He let me know what he thought of my teasing by flipping around and flicking his tail at my nose. The table was so impressive I didn't notice the smaller addition until we drew nearer. A brocade chair had been set up a few paces away from the throne, and before it, an easel. The easel was decorative, meant for displaying works rather than painting them, but it would serve its purpose.